Recorded live at 1BBSCon, August 1993 in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Tape number BB82. A Legal Issues Session with Lance Rose.
And we're an informal-looking bunch, but we actually are lawyers. I think we're also maybe the kind of lawyers who like to hang out in a group like this and maybe not be quite as starchy as a lot of lawyers do get sometimes. And I guess in terms of house rules, I don't have any, except please keep the lawyer jokes to a minimum. maybe we'll act them out for you. I'm going to very briefly introduce everybody, and some of these people may have some things, some introductory things to say. And this is really for you. You know, any kind of questions you have. I guess the other thing in terms of house rules, you know, attorneys have to live by this stuff called ethical standards, which is, in my personal view, I won't speak for the others here, is kind of a combination of true ethics and kind of lawyers retaining their client base and protecting the turf against other lawyers. And in that, but some of those rules include how you address people, how you address members of the public, how you address people who are your clients or aren't your clients. So some of you may have come here today with some specific questions about your legal situations in which you might be thinking of walking out of here with advice on what you will do in your specific situation. And I have to tell you that on an official level, we are not offering any of that. We are offering information on how the law works. You can certainly give us hypothetical situations. On the extremely limited set of facts that would be presented in any of these, we could give you what might be the case, what might be, or various senses of what might be the case based on those facts. And I know I'm speaking extremely abstractly here, but what I'm trying to say is we are not giving any actual advice. That requires an attorney-client relationship. In most cases, a lawyer. I'm kind of saying this now because I know it's going to come up in the middle of the session. I'd rather not explain it then. When you enter into an attorney-client relationship, and this is kind of important to know anyway. This is kind of how it works with lawyers. The attorney, and if they're a good one, is going to kind of drill you. They're kind of going to do a process on you like you see done in court when people get deposed, except hopefully not in a hostile manner. But they're going to go through the whole situation, including a whole bunch of facts you may not have thought relevant, and start asking all kinds of questions because they've been through it, they've been educated on the kinds of factors involved in legal situations that might make a difference. And things that you may never have thought had anything to do with it may be the pivotal factor, and the lawyer might know that and kind of hunt around for it. And that's the kind of process you have to get into if you really are involved in a tricky or important legal problem to get a real answer. I guess another part of the reason I'm saying that is because I spend a lot of my time in an online mode, so to speak. In certain areas, a lot of people know I'm a lawyer. It's not that I've hidden the fact either. And sometimes people come with very specific questions, or it's kind of obvious they're looking for an answer to bring back and apply to their lives. And you just have to understand that you can get a lot of information here. You get a lot of information in situations like that. But if it's anything that's really important in your life, and you need the legal help, you should see a lawyer. And, you know, depending on the situation, if it's a general matter, like, you know, a real estate matter or some kind of general business matter, you can see any old lawyer, so to speak, anybody that you feel comfortable with, somebody local. If it's something that has to do with something a little more specialized, say taxes or intellectual property or criminal law, something where there is kind of a very specific subset of knowledge that you can get into very deeply, it's very helpful to get a specialist, either work with the lawyer you know, who might be a generalist, or not have that specialty, and get some a little bit of consulting advice. You know, if you can get it free, fine, or if you need to pay a little bit, whatever. Get a little bit of consulting advice from the person with the knowledge, or just go and find that person to deal with directly. This is how to deal with it sensibly. One of the things lawyers see when people come to them, you know, in my practice, I'm a business kind of attorney, and I get approached. You know, I've developed a certain reputation, so people, when they're looking for help, sometimes approach me. They've heard of me or something. a lot of what I see when people come to me, I'd say half the time or more when people come to me as a business lawyer, they dump a problem in my laps. They dump a problem, and a lot of the time, it's a problem where people really, they kind of suspected that they might have, it might have been nice for them to figure things out beforehand on the legal side, but for money, based on money considerations or kind of just not wanting to really deal with it, they didn't look into it then, and then we have a nice little puzzle to unravel either, later on. And you become pretty, that's one of the ways that lawyers become pretty expert at dealing with some of the strange hypotheticals that people can come up with is they go through these things in their practice. A lot of what a lawyer does is fix what went wrong. So I'm not saying, you know, help, give the attorney part of our culture a big new infusion of cash. I'm not saying that at all. Just that, just trying to give you a sense of the outer boundaries of how working with lawyers work and approaching legal problems in a common sense way works. So, okay, now we have five people up here. Mike is certainly no more formally dressed than the rest of us. And I think we'll just go down the line. And so Mike Godwin will be first. I'll just mention briefly, Mike is the, he's a counsel, a lawyer for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a national civil liberties group, which is doing some very important work in Washington. Mike, if he chooses, can speak a little bit more on that if he'd like. I consider Mike, personally, I've considered him the main lawyer there. I'm not sure if that's reflected in the organization plan or not, but I think he's doing the most important work. He's the person who really deals with CISOP problems and other people involved in computer matters and online networks. When there's trouble, people either find their way directly to Mike or indirectly. I get a fair number of calls, or I even find out about things going on and call those people where it seems something's going on. And if they haven't already heard of the Electronic Frontier Foundation and Mike, I refer them right over because he can provide some very valuable help, and I think he does an excellent job.
Okay, I'm going to try and keep this short because my tendency is to do just the opposite. I do want to say it's very rare that I'm dressed more formally than any of these guys. One of the things, let me just tell you what I specialize in, and that may give you some thoughts as to what kind of questions you want to ask. I focus particularly on criminal law, a lot of criminal law issues, not just computer crime, although I do specialize in that too, but also criminal law issues that come up that relate to the use of computers, primarily to the use of computers for communication. So if you have questions about that, whether you might be liable, whether someone you know might be liable, I can address some of those issues. There are also a lot of constitutional law issues, specifically First Amendment issues that come up in this environment where people use computers to express themselves, and that's also a specialty of mine. As you'll find, as we discuss some of the problem areas that face SysOps and that often face BBS users, you'll often see a convergence of different areas of the law. You'll see a convergence between criminal law, First Amendment law, and copyright, for example, in some kinds of cases that face BBS operators. So I wanted to tell you, to second what Lance said about the interview process, it's often the case that I'll get a call from someone and they feel that they need to tell me their whole story in chronological order. And they're really upset when I interrupt them. They say, no, I haven't told you the best part yet. And I often, because I have to use my time and their time efficiently, I often have to sort of take control of the interview process and ask them some specific questions because, as Lance said, it's not always obvious to a non-lawyer what facts are relevant and what facts are not. And I can usually ask some pretty specific questions that enable me to help you quicker. So if that ever happens to you, if you ever call me and I end up interrupting you and asking questions and requiring that you answer my questions rather than tell me your whole story, please, I really like you and want to help you. It's not that I don't like you or have trouble with you telling me the whole story. And if we really need to, at the end of the question and answer process, I will let you tell me the whole story. So that's the summary of my method on the phone. I'll answer specific questions when we get to them. I'll try and keep this short. Thanks.
Okay, next is David Johnson. David is a partner in a large and influential Washington law firm called Wilmer, Cutler, and Pickering, and he is very involved in the kinds of legal issues that you're facing. My understanding, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, David, is that he gained a lot of experience over a number of years working for the larger online services, which is very valuable experience because they were on the scene first in a in a powerful way. While BBSs were growing, the big guys out there, CompuServe, Genie, and so forth, Delphi and Bix, the older ones, were in business for quite a while and experiencing a lot of the same problems that the smaller systems are now at least thinking about and some of them facing. And but the law is really kind of uniformly distributed throughout the whole strata, whether it's upper or lower, laterally, however you want to classify systems and how they fit in. David is also the president of a company that's in the process of creating a major online service. Well, the online, it's online today, but as you know, as just like you are, most of you are doing, it's building, called Counsel Connect, which is a system for lawyers to use. And they're in the process of changing the system, or let's say modifying the system over time so that it really is a general resource for lawyers, which heartens me a lot. And again, I guess I'll say that they're all excellent lawyers. So, and David's certainly excellent, and here he is.
Thank you, Lance. I guess I should say that the recent experience of this year of trying to create an online system to connect lawyers together has given me a particularly intense and useful experience of the difference between giving someone advice about what should be in the contract and actually signing one yourself and thinking about what those risks are and so forth. So I do, I guess, bring to the discussion some background in some of the early questions. The two perspectives I would want to particularly emphasize are that at least at the moment, a very large proportion of the questions, the legal issues facing you, can be significantly influenced, if not entirely resolved, by contract means. Because this is such a new area and the ground rules are uncertain, there is an opportunity to do a lot to mold your obligations to users and by being clear with them about what you're undertaking and what their duties are. And so contract is a very flexible regime in which you can do a lot of your own lawmaking. And the major mistake that people make is to think of law and contracts as just sort of boilerplate documents that they don't need to pay attention to and that they can either put off indefinitely or not read carefully and leave to the lawyers. And so one key message I would try to convey is that it really does matter a lot what your rules are on your system and what the terms are on which you give people access to the system. And thinking that through carefully yourself is really an inescapable duty that you face as a SysOp. Lawyers can help a little bit, but a lot of the questions as to what you want to undertake to provide commercially through the contract and so forth are your decisions to make as a business person. The second major point I'd like to make is that when third parties are affected by something that happens through your system, when you face the potential, therefore, of some tort action or criminal action or whatever, there is surprisingly a lot of influence on that also of what your contract has said and what the standard practice in the industry has come to be. The law has a tendency to defer to professional groups and those who operate in special areas of life that are complex and tend to be beyond the experience of a lot of people. Obviously, the whole online communications world is becoming mainstream, but there is still a window of opportunity, I believe, for the community of SysOps, not only on their individual boards to state clearly what the rules are of their particular road, but to join together to agree on some kinds of standards and practices that will then tend to become important in persuading a court or a legislator that is really what the standard ought to be. Now, that's not absolute. It's not the case that whatever everybody does is okay. There are some very important cases that say that if it's technically possible for you to guard against some evil that might befall your users, like a virus or whatever, then at some point there does become to be a legal duty to do that. But it's very important for you as a group to communicate very fully among yourselves as to what the technical means are and what accepted practice is and what you view as responsible practice. Because in the end, when one of these cases where someone's injured comes before a court, the problem facing the lawyer who's working for you at that time is to explain clearly why, what, even though there was something bad that happened in this case, why what you did to try to prevent it was reasonable under the circumstances, so you ought not to be held responsible for it. So in addition to paying attention to the contract terms with which you deal with users, you should pay attention to the industry standard and join together, really, and help to mold what that standard is and over time articulate responsible norms that, that allow the people who go to the legislatures and the courts on your behalf to argue that there ought to be substantial deference given to the kinds of trade-offs that you have to make every day.
Thank you, David. The next lawyer to speak to you is Pete Kennedy. Pete kind of plunged swiftly into the world of BBSs by becoming involved in the case of Steve Jackson Games against the United States. After Steve Jackson Games was raided, for the one or two of you who may actually not have heard about this, raided by the by certain agents of the federal government because one of his employees was somebody that they thought was a hacker and happened to be a sysop within his job duties for the Steve Jackson Games customer support board, and therefore they thought it was a hacker, an evil hacker board harboring a lot of dark secrets about the telephone company, and therefore took away Steve Jackson's support board and any other computer they can find in the place, and had a hard time getting the computer back, and Steve, of course, was never charged with anything. And a case fell out of this against the government. Steve is a pretty obstinate guy, I guess, when it comes to defending his rights. And he ended up retaining the firm that Pete's with, George Donaldson and Ford. Pete is an attorney there, and he actually handled the trial. So he was right there in the lines and got a real fast education on what BBSing is all about and has played an important part in kind of helping formulate and conceptualize what BBS rights are about in search and seizure situations. Since that time, Pete seems to have remained interested in the BBS world, and I've seen him around a lot, which I'm very glad about. And his background, though, did not start with the Steve Jackson Games case. Pete and the firm he's involved with is a very in Texas, is a very very involved in media, publishing and media cases, which is a lot of the heritage that bulletin boards are now within. People running bulletin boards are publishing, they are distributing the publications and the speech of others, and all of that is within the same tradition of traditional media publishing, which Pete has a hell of a lot of experience in. Pete.
Well, thanks. Lance said most of everything I was going to say to introduce myself. He is right that we got involved in Steve Jackson Games sort of through the back door, the fact that we had represented a lot of traditional publishers and had done a lot of work in constitutional law, and were a small firm of trial lawyers and had experience in actually putting on lawsuits. And for me, learning the technology and then going through the experience of trying to translate that and explain it to a judge who had absolutely no familiarity with computers at all or computer communications, bulletin board systems, was very difficult and useful experience for me as a trial lawyer. And it's something that you all need to keep in mind, that I'm the kind of lawyer that gets involved when things go wrong. And you'll always need to have people who can translate what you're doing to someone who knows even less than you do about it, and to understand the core issues that are involved in what y'all do, that basically it's communications between people, and that the technology is the substructure of it, but it's not the content. And you know, we face the problem of trying to get a West Texas judge to understand and sympathize with not only computer users, but a specialized subset of that, bulletin board users, and then an even odder subset of that, folks who are interested in fantasy role-playing games and like to talk about them over bulletin board systems. And we just kind of threw around different ways of doing it and gave up, and we just took the board into the courtroom and reconstructed it just as it was, the way that Steve was running it at the time it got seized, and sat the judge down in front of it and said, "Judge, this is what a board is," and ran it for him for about a half an hour and walked him through it. And there seemed to have been no better way than for him to get the idea. And it was surprising that when you do run into legal problems, you're going to find judges that, although they're not sophisticated and familiar with the technology, they very quickly can pick up on the ideas and understand what's going on. And we were pleased that Judge Sparks was actually able to understand most of the core of what the suit was about and to, you know, come out mostly our way on it. So I'm not going to give any long description of the case. I think most of you are pretty familiar, but I'm up here happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Pete. Okay, Ken Smiley is an attorney who's very active in the bulletin board community. He's online a lot, working dealing with SysOps, answering their questions in a non-client attorney way, except for clients. Ken has one of the reasons I'm very interested in seeing Ken here. We've been talking in recent months about the insurance question, and one of the ways that you do handle some of the things that might go wrong is through insurance. Not everything. If the police want to come in and take your equipment, the insurance agent is not necessarily going to stand there and stop them. But nonetheless, there are a lot of things that bulletin boards do have to be concerned about that insurance can't address, and there are issues about getting insurance. One fairly well-publicized incident involving bulletin boards had to do with the Event Horizons bulletin board, which caught some hell from Playboy on some claims that he was distributing their images, which I won't comment on the claims one way or another. As Jim tells me, the very large suit was handled either wholly or largely by his insurance company. He had managed to get insurance. He's also a pretty big board. I think insurance is a very important subject. I'm still in the process of trying to figure out what it's all about myself. I don't hang around a lot with insurance companies. Maybe I should a little bit more. Ken has hung around with insurance companies a little bit. He worked with one for a while. He's on his own now. He's certainly capable of speaking about all the legal issues that you might want to raise. And I would also like him to, if he would, say a couple of words about insurance.
Sure. I guess I want to say that I was a programmer and a SysOp long before I was ever an attorney or was ever involved any way with insurance. And I kind of brought my experience in doing that with me when I went to work for a company called Media Professional Insurance, that the name is very glitzy, but some of the nuts and bolts really isn't. And they like to cover people like magazines, newspapers, telephone book publishers. I think we had a lot of publishing clients out there, even some large bulletin board systems that they didn't even consider them bulletin board systems because they didn't know what they were. They were online services. I had approached them at one point about, you know, there are a lot of bulletin board systems out there. There are a lot of issues that for example, copyright or defamation that you provide coverage for that these people might like to be able to get a policy. Over the last few months, I've been negotiating with a couple of the largest companies that do deal in these type of policies. I'm happy to report that they are available to everyone. I can give you more details on those after the discussion in private if you'd like. I'm a little unhappy to report that the minimum amount of premium that one of these companies wants is $1,000 a year, which tends to put insurance out of the reach of the average, everyday, single-line SysOp. But I'm working to try to get that to change. Working to, you know, try to get them to modify their policies. So I do have a background in insurance, and you know, I'll field any questions that you might have on that. And I'd also like to state that I do, as Lance said, like to get on daily onto FidoNet has a BBS Law Echo that I like to give on and give non-attorney clients advice on. And I always try to preface that or have a tagline that tells everyone that you know, go see an attorney in your area. But I'll be happy to direct you to where to go or to try to answer your hypotheticals, and I'll try to do that here as well.
Thanks, Ken. Actually, I'm heartened to hear what you had to say, because that's a little bit better than the last discussion we had about it. Sounds like there's a little bit of progress in the insurance area. $1,000 is quite a bit for a hobbyist. It's not a whole lot for somebody who's making their livings off BBS. I can tell you it's a small fraction of attorney insurance, much less doctor insurance. So that doesn't sound too bad to me, but obviously everybody has to check their own pocketbook for that. So now, let's see, I don't know that we set up microphones, and the questions won't come through.
Are there any microphones? There's one over there.
There's a clip microphone over there.
It's very loud. It's very loud, so don't put the thing right in your mouth. Yes, anybody has questions, just take turns asking questions at the microphone.
Yeah, could you guys discuss right of reply or right to reply, and whether you know, if you've got any predictions about whether that's going to be a way of
avoiding defamation problems?
Well, I think it would be strong to say it's a way of avoiding it, but I think it's a very good idea. And there's a recent Law Journal article arguing that if you provide a very robust right of reply, that you may be able to raise a defense against the claim that you're liable for someone else's defamation through your system. So, and as I understand it, Dave Hughes tells great stories about how when people get very upset about some nasty comments made, that in every case he brings people in and gives them an opportunity to express their frustration, the situation tends to diffuse itself. So at least as a practical matter, and maybe as a legal defense, I think it's a very effective strategy. The idea here is that if somebody puts something up on the board that is defamatory in the sense that it injures the reputation of some third party, and I guess this works primarily for a third party who is also a member of the board, one strategy to follow is to make sure that your rules and your operations provide that injured or offended person with the opportunity to make an equivalent statement in rebuttal, if you will.
Okay, go on.
I want to second. I think David is referring particularly to Ed Cavazos' article. Ed Cavazos, who is a SysOp and a recent graduate of the University of Texas School of Law, has an article that appeared, I guess, this year in the Review of Litigation, which is a law review published at the University of Texas, that deals just with the right of reply. And I think it's a very good article because it points out how this medium, the unique dynamics of this medium seem to require a different kind of defamation model or model for defamation remedies than some of the other media that are out there. One of the things, though, that's worth pointing out is that the notion of right of reply and what a right of reply might mean is actually an old one. In the traditional public figure, private individual distinction that one sees in the Supreme Court cases, one of the justifications that's raised for the distinction between private figures and public figures, and giving less protection, by the way, to public figures, is that public figures sort of have a right of reply. You know, they can go to media, they can hold press conferences. It's a lot easier for them to respond to attacks on their reputation. One of the reasons I'm writing an article about this, by the way, for Internet World, I think it's worth noting how few defamation cases have come up in the bulletin board or online conferencing environment. There have been a few. I think one of the reasons there have been relatively few, however, is that most people who are online in these conferences feel empowered to respond. It's only when you feel totally disempowered that you feel that you have to go to your lawyer.
I'd like to add a couple more things. Right of reply is a very active subject in the general legal community right now, not just in the bulletin board situation. I'd also like to mention that the article by Ed Cavazos, who I also believe is if he was here, and I don't believe he is, I would gladly have asked him to be involved in this too. He's like Ken, he's very active and online, and I believe he's very very devoted to working with people in the bulletin board community. And his article has gotten a lot of attention. I don't know exactly how, you know, what this will mean to each of you, but I know that Prodigy has taken his article very seriously and is working with a right of reply model to deal with some of these the issues that Mike was talking about. I'm not sure exactly how they're going to end up surfacing, but I know they are working on that. The one last thing I want to mention about that is there's a one of the ways that laws get created in this country is through so-called uniform acts, where the states individually enact laws based on a model, and if over a period of a few years they all the states happen to enact the laws based on this model, and there's kind of a push to do this from time to time, you end up with a national law that's not federal, but based on all the states agreeing to make the state laws work the same way. The Uniform Defamation Act is in this process right now, and it is based largely on making right of reply the first remedy in defamation cases generally, not just on BBSs, but in all situations.
Okay, Nick.
Well, actually, no, I'd like to move to another subject, and if time opens up and people run out later, we can come back to it.
Where can we get a copy of that article?
Ed Cavazos' article? I'm not positive.
He has a copy online. And in fact, if you send electronic mail to Polcat, polecat at tick.com. That's P-O-L-E-K-A-T at T-I-C.com. And request a copy of the article. He has a copy in ASCII that he can mail you.
Thank you, Mike. Polecat, I guess, is one of the handles that goes by. Okay, next question.
Yeah, I just was going to ask the panel to give some recommendations or legal situation that would be involved. If messages posted in public forums were copied and redistributed electronically or in printed material?
I'll just start by saying whether or not that's a problem depends a lot on whether the understanding that you've reached with users is that that's permissible. I know of some systems where the rules provide that everybody on the system grants, even though they retain in some sense a copyright to whatever they put up, they grant a license to everyone on the system to use the copy capability to send messages to others. And I think there are I know there are systems where the opposite rule applies. The question is not just whether someone owns, in some sense, a copyright to their posting, but whether it's in an area that's understood to be public and whether they have impliedly granted a license for someone to rebroadcast that. So there's both an ownership interest and a sort of an expectation of some variation on the right of privacy there. I think that's a perfect example where clear rules stating what is expected to be done and what you're permitted to do as a user are very important.
I'd like to follow. Not to preempt other. You know, we can also speak on this. I tend to get really long-winded about this, probably because one of my areas of more intense interest is copyright and things like that. And I've been long-winded about it so many times. I could probably say it more briefly now. People are working with a lot of different models for how to do that. There are a lot of people working on various copyright clearance and control systems to try to handle it. I'm not going to get into the whole problem right now. The basic question is, when you put something online, how far have you authorized it to go? This is the question as I see it, just by putting it online. To me, that depends where you put it online, if there are already rules there about what happens to things online. It could also have to do with what you say about what you've put online. And this is a very open issue. On a very informal basis, I would say that if somebody puts something online in a small bulletin board system, somebody else decides to take that and publish it in a book, I think at the very least we have a substantial legal claim there. I can't say necessarily that the person saying you've violated my copyright by putting the book would win, but that's not a case that gets thrown out of court. That's a real battle. The other thing I'd like to say is David mentioned something about needing rules in this area. One of the questions to me is whether we need to make new rules or whether we can work in more of a contract sense. I'm sure all of you are familiar with shareware. Shareware is kind of similar. Shareware goes out with, and shareware is kind of part of the question here. It goes out with some terms attached. And you know, and it says you can use it for a while. If you want to take it and download it, you can use it for a while, but if you use it past a certain point, you're supposed to pay me or else you're doing it illegally. It says you can distribute it free if you keep all the files in the shareware together so you don't alter them, except maybe zip it up and put something on the outside saying how wonderful your BBS is or something. But you can't, say, distribute it on disks unless you contact the author, or charge money for getting the share unless you contact the author, usually because the author wants a piece of that money. and they have the license terms included in the shareware package as part of it. Now, you can't do that, say, in a public discussion situation, on a message by message. You could, but it gets pretty messy having to read everybody's copyright terms as you're trying to have a discussion. Might be even harder in a chat situation. however, there might be analogs might be possible, analogs to the shareware model, some way of everybody setting what, and the other thing about, there's a question of enforceability. The question is kind of getting resolved in a funny way. Congress passed a law kind of recognizing shareware as a thing and saying the Copyright Office will have a registry for shareware license terms. Copyright Office then created a registry for shareware license terms. Anybody with shareware can say what their license terms are, stick it in the Copyright Office. Okay, and if somebody wants to violate the license terms, see someone distribute the shareware without permission, and the thing ends up in court, a lot of judges will be impressed if somebody says, hey, I registered my shareware license terms at the Copyright Office. That means something, doesn't it, Judge? So I think that's how the issue is getting resolved. Shareware is getting a lot of legitimacy for its approach. I think that can be applied to other things. And very briefly, just to go maybe to where it might end, if it ends up being resolved on a contractual licensing level, it could end up with a system sometime in the future where people keep license terms, everybody keeps their own license terms, say on a server somewhere, say we're talking in an internet environment. So if somebody wants to take something and do something with it, there's a fairly easy way to find out what that person says you can do with their stuff. Go to that site. Maybe there can be a centralized site. I also think it might end up involving encryption techniques that are now being talked about a lot, public key encryption techniques, so that people can authenticate license terms. I might not like somebody, so I may feel like I want to screw around with their copyrights and put down their license terms and just not say it, you know, not say it's me, say it's them. So there would have to also be an authentication component to the storage of license terms to know that it's really the person.
Could I just disagree one slight bit with what you said, because I don't think the endpoint here needs to be every sysop reinventing the wheel and coming up with an infinite variety of different terms for rules governing these things.
I wasn't saying sysops. I meant users, actually.
Well, okay. Well, then I guess I more strongly disagree. I think one of the roles played by a contractual legal system is that it helps people to simplify relationships and creates a shorthand that avoids having to invest the costs in renegotiating and rethinking through all the terms applicable to everything all the time. If you were at Anne Branscombe's great session yesterday, she raised the current problems that with the Berne Convention having been signed, there's no longer a requirement for notice of whether or not someone claims a copyright, and there's an expansion in the fair use doctrine, and there's a recent case that eliminates some protection, and that really creates a substantial degree of uncertainty as to whether what you're dealing with is something that you have the right to copy or not. I agree with Lance that if you take wholesale discussion threads off a bulletin board and publish them for profit in a book, you've got a serious case. And on the other hand, if you get something by email directly addressed to you and you send it to a friend, that's maybe an easier case. I think there's an opportunity and really almost a need for the industry, if you will, to sit down and talk through seriously what the different models might be. There doesn't have to be just one model, but just as the software licensing group got together and over time refined a lot of contracts and many, many companies choose to use particular flavors of licensing contracts, whether they're shareware or particular kinds of shrink wrap context, this industry could come up with some general understandings which could then be referred to by a short name. And so you could have in the sign-on screen of your bulletin board saying this bulletin board abides by the Lance Rose Convention on shared comments or whatever. And that would, I think, be a very important advance in the way these things are understood and handled and reduce everybody's hassle.
Well, okay, thanks. I don't think we really disagree. I think those, you know, what I was talking about with David, they're almost like alternate mechanics. The mechanics, people work on the mechanics, but the sense that we will all, you know, we can have several conventions again, so we can choose the licensing we want if the conventions, any of the conventions available, do work for us. So these are the kinds of things that probably will end up happening at some point. It's hard to say it right now, though, what it is. Anything else?
Just one thing I wanted to mention, a problem that I've seen come up several times. A sysop will get on and say, somebody local to me came on my message base and saw how active it was, and they took all my messages and started their own BBS and have that big message base now and are tracking all my callers. You know, they're all going there because, you know, he or she charges less or doesn't charge at all, and I do. And I think you come across the same situations where if somebody takes all of your message threads and puts them in a book, that there's serious problems with that.
Thank you. Okay. Next.
I'm interested in setting up a Consumers of Medical Care bulletin board, which will obviously be very controversial. Part of what I'd like to have on the board would be the credentials in all public record issues of all health providers, including licensing actions, malpractice things. In addition, the idea of having the consumers be able to comment on their experiences. This person kept me waiting for 4 hours, whatever. Because outcome in healthcare actually happens to be, of all the variables, consumer satisfaction is highly correlated with successful outcomes. Now, obviously, there will be critical comments made, and people will be allegedly defamed without knowing it. Would you have any comments on this idea? My point basically being that most people know a hell of a lot more about buying a Lexus or even a Chevy than they do about having their heart cleaned out, and there needs to be some way of trying to get some of this data
Okay, I just want to ask you something. You're talking about the customers of the doctors making comments about them?
Yes.
Not the doctors themselves?
No. Unfortunately, I'm a physician, and the medical profession tends to hide most of it. We bury our dead. and we getting information and exchanging information about, if you notice, for example, on car forums, people talk a lot about what was wrong with the transmission of the early Chevy vans, Plymouth vans, and so forth. People don't discuss very often their experiences, which can be very costly and sometimes unfortunate in healthcare, and okay. particularly hospitals, for example. And I know it's gutsy, I know it's dicey, but at the same time, there needs to be some forum. People start to do it in their special interest groups.
Okay, thanks. I'll start off with a couple of fast comments. First of all, you know we're not going to give you specific legal advice, as I said, but we'll talk. We can talk about it. This is definitely see a lawyer type stuff. Second of all, second of all, I think, and this is actually what lawyers. This is what I do as a lawyer. Maybe I'm wrong in doing this. My first reaction is this is seems to be more a political problem in a lot of ways than a legal problem. Doctors are pretty tough politically, and if they don't like somebody setting up something that is not totally squeaky clean in any way, they're going to go after you like gangbusters. And that would be my first question, is that really what you want to get involved in? Doctors, I certainly don't know your situation. I've seen my share of doctors who make lawyers pale by comparison in terms of the amount they charge people for the amount of work they do. And
you should be on my board.
Yeah. Well, any of these, but doctors feel the opposite way. But anybody that can threaten the livelihood of somebody who's really interested in making a lot of money from being a doctor is a target, and will get hit hard, I think. I think if other people have legal comments, I just want to make those couple.
Go ahead, David.
Well, the obvious thing you have to worry about is defamation, but you ought to think also about, it occurs to me just thinking about it, the potential argument that the people on the board are straying into practicing medicine without a license, which may not be a fair argument, but one that you ought to anticipate and think through how you set up the rules so that you at least keep to a minimum the extent to which the consumer's comments could be mischaracterized after the fact by an angry medical association as giving each other medical advice and in a context where that was very dangerous and so forth.
Yeah, okay. Before you do, just hang on to a second. Yes, for instance, someone can say that doctor set my arm in a totally wrong way. You have to do it this way. You don't do it the way the guy did it. That's why my arm is all twisted up now. Okay, that kind of comment. You know, he's saying he knows what he's talking about, and that's how you set arms. That's just one small example, but that's the kind of thing that could really happen here. Please speak into the microphone.
Is that if I give advice, I guess it's the same thing, the legal thing, if I give advice, and I do that on CompuServe very often, people are suggesting things they might want to do, how do you avoid getting involved in a professional relationship, a doctor-patient relationship or a lawyer-client relationship? Do you need a disclaimer each time?
Well, I did it here at the beginning of the I'm not sure you need a disclaimer each time. I think you really have to go play it by ear. If it's kind of clear that you're just giving information on a general basis, it's kind of clear you're not getting into a client relationship with anyone. If somebody gives you a hypothetical that anybody with half a brain can tell, they're talking about their own situation or their friends, and you kind of and you feel motivated to give them some helpful advice because there's a person asking for some advice, yeah, that might be the time to do the disclaimer, a very pointed disclaimer, which, although you're trying to be helpful, at the same time, it's like, go see a doctor, go see a lawyer. You got to make a point of saying that. I mean, you don't have to make a point of saying, that's just my personal view. You have to kind of make a point where you feel the greatest potential for misinterpretation of what's going on arises.
Maybe I can start a fight here by saying I don't think that disclaimers always work, even if you say you're not giving legal advice or medical advice or whatever. If the objective facts are such that it's somebody who a judge would say after the fact that someone's relying on it and that you've entered into that relationship, the fact that you put those words there is not going to help.
Yeah, look, one more thing, and then this will be the last time because we have other people. But you'll have another shot after this. I do actually, now that David mentions that, there are times, even when people don't ask me a question, but if I'm hanging around where I see a lawyer being asked something or something, I'll say to people, it looks like you're asking something you should really be taking to a lawyer. There is a point, very, and you have to.
I can share with people that I tried not to do that, but I had one or two people I started talking to who got incredibly involved and started getting angry when I tried to disengage. And I found that I could get, unfortunately, into a doctor-patient relationship on email where people became very dependent on my advice and then started sending me nasty letters, even a malpractice kind of joke letter.
I have a very simple suggestion. First of all, you have to be prepared to incur some people's wrath. You let people know you were a doctor and you got to pay for it. The second thing is that I would suggest that you have a couple of ASCII files waiting around for just such situations. And when you get in one of those situations, upload the ASCII file that explains why you can't do certain things. You don't even have to waste time on it. Just upload the file if you have to explain it every now and then.
Yeah, one of the problems for professionals is that when push comes to shove, the determination of whether there's a attorney-client or a doctor-patient relationship isn't based on what the attorney or the doctor thinks. It's based upon, in part, what the client or the patient thinks, and then whether that belief is reasonable or not. So it's nothing you can ever guarantee from your side as a professional.
We've been kind of bantering around back up here behind the microphone, so to speak, and insurance keeps coming up. I would think you probably want to look into that if you're going to be running a board of that type with that much controversy perhaps happening, as I'm probably aware that you have your own insurance yourself that may come into play.
As I'm sure you know, doctors hate all lawyers except their own.
Okay, next question.
What kinds of problems might be anticipated in the case of a board that is providing a personal financial planning information and discussion?
Well, I guess I'll start. This is another regulated industry, just like doctors and lawyers. People who offer financial advice are regulated by the Securities Exchange Commission, and certain types of advice or the rendering of certain kinds of advice can be held to be something that only a registered investment advisor could do. I don't know if the other people are. I'm not an expert on that area of law. I know that area of law exists, and certainly could look it up if I needed to, as many lawyers could. But there are issues of that sort. There is also a case which is a little different. Most of you may have heard of it by now. There was something called the Money Talks area of Prodigy. And as we know, Prodigy is a pretty popular system. Somebody was heavily putting down a stock and saying that a company, a very up-and-coming company in the medical business called Medphone, which had a product that apparently, I don't know the exact mechanics of it, could somehow let doctors over long range help heart attack victims with some device that would be there. And they would be somewhere else connected by like wireless or telephone or something. Very up-and-coming, high-tech medical device company. And he was saying that there were real problems with the products and the stock price was false and the thing would be falling. And the stock price eventually did fall, and they blamed it on this guy in Prodigy. And they sued the heck out of him for and mostly for libel. There is a Securities Act claim, but also a what lawyers call a common law libel claim under state law, which is that he said false things about the company making the stock drop. I also, in writing a little, small, tiny little piece on this for a magazine, I talked to somebody very involved in the financial investment industry who told me that, they can say what they like. The way it really works is that there are companies around to affect stock prices that will use rumors as a basis to spread bad information about a stock. They'll sell short and watch the stock fall and make money. So what the guy was saying on Prodigy could very well have been the rumor opportunistic broker used to get what they wanted in terms of selling short. And that's kind of a little bit more deeper into how the business works. Doesn't mean there isn't a risk, though. The guy did end up getting sued. That's another kind of thing that can happen. You're walking into an area where there's millions and millions of bucks at stake, and if somebody does feel their stock price or something was affected, you can also have people giving out inside information they're not supposed to. Companies can get very creative when they have a lot of money to pay a lawyer to figure out how to sue somebody. You're walking into an area where if you become influential in people's actions in relation to a company, they could have something to say. I guess what I would suggest before anybody else is that you do see a lawyer and that you also work out an understanding with your users, and that there might be certain types of strong control that you would have to exercise at points where you feel that the risk is too great, and you should be able to set the ground rules in advance so that when you do exercise that control, you're only doing what you told users you would do from the beginning.
I just have two comments. In addition, the way you asked the question, it was not clear whether the advice was being offered in effect by the board, as you might have been said in a way to imply that, as opposed to the board offering a means of transmission for someone else offering the advice. And obviously a key ideal here is to position yourself not as the source of that kind of message. If you do have a situation where somebody is using your board to do something that might be viewed by the securities regulators as manipulating the market or whatever, you have to bear in mind it's not just a question of a civil suit. The SEC is in the business of investigating that kind of thing. They are used to using very sweeping administrative subpoenas and opening informal investigations and so forth. They really hadn't, until quite recently, even heard of the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. And you might face something in the nature of an administrative subpoena or a request from a local office of the Securities and Exchange Commission to turn over all your records, at which point you should see a lawyer, but you should particularly be focusing on the question of whether, for example, you have some in your contract with your users, some obligation to give them notice if the government comes in any of its forms asking for you to disclose to the government the contents of communications that might otherwise have been private email communications, for example, on your system. And you should take a close look at whether the Electronic Communications Privacy Act requires the government to have a warrant as opposed to an administrative subpoena to get access to those records.
I'd like to add one more thing. You do have the First Amendment on your side. People should be able to talk about things. The First Amendment is under development here. You know, you're operating a board, just like in all other legal areas, the fact that it's an electronic bulletin board will be seized on by some as having a lot more legal significance than it should. Okay, you should be treated the same way as the press is. And I am aware that in the securities and related investment industries, sometimes when there's problems about whether someone is offering investment advice or not, it might be because they were doing something in a newsletter distributed to a bunch of people, and then they will claim that they have a First Amendment right to distribute newsletters as opposed to this securities industry or commodities industry desire to say, no, you have to be registered with us to do the type of thing you're doing. So stuff, you know, there's a certain area in which it's in play. You know, whether you're doing a First Amendment type of thing, whether you're doing something that somehow moved out of the First Amendment, got into an exception because you did this heavily regulated activity.
Let me just add one point that's interesting about the case that has been referred to about Prodigy is that the SysOps in that case, Prodigy Management, were not parties to the suit. The civil plaintiffs did not try to sue Prodigy in that case. They went after the person who originated the comments about their business.
Okay, thank you.
I would like to ask you gentlemen a question, and I think this is the forum where I'm hoping I'll get an explanation without the word reasonable care in it. But my question is directed to duties and the scope of those duties that a SysOp may have in publishing copyrighted images. How far must they reach to make sure that they have permission or license from the copyright holder? And let me take that one step further, because especially after the Jackson case and with some of the recent government movements. For me, on all my original images, I require all the way down to not only a model's release, but I require from the models proof of age. And without that, my feelings, and Stan, correct me if you think I am wrong, transmitting adult, quote, sexually oriented images wireless across state lines may cause at some point down the road the Mann Act to come into effect. And I'd like to hear some response on that. But I at the show, thank goodness I heard the lecture on sense of community, but I found somebody in the exhibit hall showing my copyrighted images for which they thought they had a license, but the person that granted it did not have that authority. And my question that came up to me was, how far is it responsible for him to go to really find out if he has a true license, or if there are model releases, or if the model is underage?
You may not realize this, but you've actually raised two sets of unrelated questions. Okay, well, good. I'm glad you did realize it. The first set of questions has to do with copyright and duty of care. You should know that with regard to innocent, what's called innocent infringement, not civil copyright infringement, duty of care is not really part of the analysis. If you're an infringer, even if you were really reasonable about trying to prevent infringement on your system, you're still liable. I mean, it's not, you don't escape from that liability by saying, well, I looked at every image and I double-checked everything and I made this person sign an affidavit. That doesn't work. Criminal infringement is a different issue, but that's not really the issue you raise. Criminal infringement does look at the intent and conduct of the individual defendant. But in this particular case, I think the one you're raising about, you know, your standard of care in a civil context, I think there's really no, it's just not the kind of question to ask. So I'm happy to be able to answer your question and say there's no reasonable duty of care issue there, or at least not directly. With regard to adult images being transported across state lines in the Mann Act, the Mann Act is always brings back memories of the bootlegging era, you know, and a weird other era of federal law enforcement. But strictly speaking, I understand that that particular law addressed moving human beings across state lines, not moving images. And I don't think there's really an issue relating to the Mann Act in your transmission of images. There may be other issues, by the way. There are two sets of issues that occur to me, and one of them is obscenity. You may violate the obscenity law in a local jurisdiction depending on what your models are doing in their images. And the second thing is exposure of sexually oriented material to children is a potential problem. Even if that material is non-obscene, it may create liability for you under a statute designed to protect children.
I'd like to just quickly clarify, not clarify, add to, and Mike, if you feel I added wrongly, please feel free to say so. Mike said that you're liable, and it is true. You're liable even if you're a perfectly innocent infringer. I would like to explain that a little bit further. Liability means that you are found to have infringed. Then you get in the legal analysis and the way the legal process works, okay, that's the status. It's like in the criminal process, you're guilty, now what's your sentence? In the civil side, you're liable, now what's the remedy for the person who sued you? Okay, there's a few remedies in copyright law. The first primary remedy is injunction, okay, which is the person who is found to have infringed has to stop. Okay, if you're liable, you have to stop. That's always the first, okay, once that finding is made in court. Now, the next question is, if you made money, or if the person who sued you lost money, right, in the measure of damages, how much, you know, if you made money, they lost money, is the court going to give the person who sued you some money? Whether you intentionally infringe somebody will be a very important factor there. At that point, we're looking at what's fair. Okay, if the person was really innocent and the person had a windfall of zillions of dollars, okay, even though they were very innocent, the judge will not feel too bad taking at least some of that money and giving it to the guy who sued him, as innocent as they were, because they made a lot of money off the copyrighted image. If he's innocent and he didn't make too much money, and if he also extended himself away based on that it might really injure him to give that money over, the judge could come to a very different result. I'm not saying the judge wouldn't give any money, although he might, or he might just give a little. And, you know, you also look at the damage to the plaintiff. You look at opportunities the plaintiff may have lost to say license to somebody else because they say, why should I license from you? It's over there. They're already in the market. They might have lost business opportunities. A lot of factors come in to determining money issues after the liability issue. Injunction always follows. Whether damages are going to be paid, how much they are, and I'm not getting into all the factors here, is another question. And Mike was also talking about different kinds of legal issues raised, and I also heard the word model release. I don't believe you talked about right of publicity or right of privacy. That's another set of legal issues that comes up in that situation. It's not a copyright question. There are copyright questions, but there are also questions with a model of whether they do have rights, okay, and there's a background of, you know, especially, say, with young women, okay, that you know, naked pictures of young women where they sometimes get exploited. You know, they're kind of young, and an older kind of operator guy talked them into taking off their clothes, and next thing you know, they're making zillions of bucks off it. Courts can get pretty protective sometimes. And even, you know, if there's a contract, courts can really play the game of saying, does that contract give that exact right to do that exact thing in trying to protect this kind of young person who got hoodwinked a bit? So there are rights of privacy, rights of publicity, that if you're going to get into that area at all, a very good release, a very well-drafted release, which the model really understands that they're signing the right way, can be very important. Any other comments? Okay, next.
Are SysOps required or obligated to maintain recordings such as recordings of chat areas and email, and if so, for how long?
No.
Caveat. Wait, thank you. I can't let that clear an answer be given here.
I knew that there was going to be a follow-up when I said that, but in general, the answer is no. There might be some circumstances in which it would be appropriate to keep a copy, but there's not a general legal duty that I'm aware of under federal law or any state jurisdiction that requires that. Sometimes, by the way, the government can require it. For example, under ECPA, the government, in the course of an investigation, this is Title 18, Section 2704, can require you to keep a backup as evidence. Even if they're not taking it away, they can just require you to make one pursuant to that part of the statute. But if you haven't heard from the government yet, you don't have to do it pursuant to that part of the statute. And David has some more comments.
No, that was the caveat, that there can be a... The government can come in and require you to take what's called a snapshot of the database.
Yeah, and also those of you who are involved in very specific kind of industries, niche areas, there are certain, and I don't know if any of you guys are into banking, for instance, but there are certain particular industries that have record-keeping requirements. I would at least hope that you know that you're in that industry and would, you know, look into that if you are.
It's also just, it's a characteristic of the Electronic Communications Privacy Act that there's a different level of protection afforded to records of communications after 180 days. So if you do keep a long archival record and so forth, you should be aware that there are slightly different standards applicable to what the government needs to use to get access to that if it's doing an investigation. That may lead some people to have policies that get rid of archives after a certain period of time.
Thank you. Next.
As a result of some of the commercial board activities and the existence of some encryption schemes, some of the SysOps have been advised as to what their rights might or might not be with regard to public versus private areas on a bulletin board. One apparent remedy there is to post notices at the beginning of a log-on screen, very much like a shrink-wrap contract on a piece of software. Would you comment about perhaps provide advice to SysOps in general in terms of what you do to set the rules on your system at logon?
I want to go a little with this because it's probably one of the most frequently asked questions on the BBS Law Echo is, here's an example of my logon screen. Is it any good? And I see a lot of those, and I try to help out, make comments, and say, well, this may really not mean anything. And I know Lance and I have had discussions about affirmations of online contracts, and it's my view that if you can get it in writing, you're probably better off. If you can't get it in writing, you ought to have the bulletin appear in some sort of record field that asks them yes or no, or whatever the answer may be on this, before they proceed, and that you will have some sort of evidence, some sort of record of their affirmation to this. If you have just a bulletin screen and nothing else, and it appears on logon, maybe only the first time they ever log on, I can tell you at 14.4 V32, I can't read what's going up the screen, you know, that fast, and you know, I may forget about it and might not use my back scroll to go see it. So did I ever even see it? There aren't any cases that I know of that have ever gone into this. But it is a hot topic. A lot of people, you know, want to know, is what I'm saying any good? And
well, there is one case that might be slightly relevant. It had to do with software licensing. The Vault case in Louisiana suggested that where an adhesion contract, one that was not subject to negotiation, that was simply a shrink wrap contract, purported to override rights that a software licensee would otherwise have in the copyright law, that was preempted by federal law. So one answer I would add is that it matters a little bit whether the terms you're imposing conflict with a strong public policy or might otherwise be unconscionable. Just two other things. I agree absolutely that you ought to provide a screen that pauses and offers yes, no. I have seen systems where no matter what you answer, you go on in anyway, and that's not enough. You really have to give people a meaningful no option to kick out of the system. And one other thing to think about is that And I think a very useful possibility in structuring your relationships is to have, for example, a written agreement that incorporates by reference the rules of the system, but then makes clear that the rules may change from time to time and that they're available on the system. Because one of the problems is that if you try to do things in a written contract, you will run into problems and want to change the terms from time to time, and unless you incorporate that explicitly into the agreement regime, you might be stuck having to redo those written contracts or basically pretending, acting as if they're not there, which would tend to discredit them. The problem then becomes if you change your rules in a way that doesn't really effectively come to the notice of the users and is otherwise unconscionable, that might not be given effect.
Okay, I might have a series of a few comments here, like David. I want to underline the reference to contracts that he made when I was writing this book, Syslaw, about this law for online people. After I got into it for a while, I kept scratching my head and saying, there's so many different ways that the laws apply to bulletin boards. How can anybody keep all this stuff straight? And kind of what I was driven to was a solution. I mean, there's a couple of pieces of the solution. But one of them was contracts. Other pieces might be incorporation, just for liability shielding, insurance, as we've been talking about, knowing how to deal with messages, picking up some understanding and knowledge like you people are doing. Another, to me, very important part of it is having an agreement with users at the outset, including the ability to modify it over time, but just the fact of having an agreement. There are questions about the enforceability of things. As David pointed out, Vault, in fact, is not the only one. That's one case. There's a couple. In fact, on the shrink wrap license front, the packages we tend to buy in the store shelves, the software and stuff. Lawyers, there is still some debate among lawyers. If you ask lawyers for the software industry, they'll tell you shrink wrap licenses are as solid as a battleship. If you ask other lawyers who are involved in the industry but not in that particular client relationship, many of them, including myself, will tell you shrink wrap licenses have more holes than Swiss cheese. And that's certainly my personal view. I've seen shrink wrap license, the question of enforceability of shrink wrap licenses come up about three times with resounding unenforceable decisions each time. I haven't seen a single case where shrink wrap license terms have been enforced yet. Putting stuff up on the screen at the beginning of getting into a service is just like a shrink wrap license, which is, I guess, what David was saying. There is that problem. Do you have a chance to negotiate the terms? And that's going to be an ongoing problem. If people want to take that approach, what I've recommended to them in the past, you can't overcome the question of whether you can negotiate the terms or not, but you can at least get one thing more than somebody who sells a package on a store can get. You can tell them that they will be bound by the system rules. You can actually tell them they have to look at the system rules before they're getting into the system. And one thing I've recommended to people, and most of them, and this will lead to the next thing I want to mention for a moment, most of them haven't done, the people I've made this recommendation to, is force people into an absolutely unambiguous character string that they store in a very secure and orderly way. There's no question they agreed to it. That one thing that you wouldn't be able to say is that this person didn't know they were being told they agreed to something before they went in. So you could say, here's some rules, and you hopefully don't, run them through, a world full of screens about what they're supposed to do and not do, because you just won't get many users. But at the end, that you could say something like, do you agree to these terms? I would say, okay, tell them that they have to type in the following. Yes, I agree to the terms that I just read in the following three screens. Anybody who goes that far, okay, especially if you make it kind of unique, so it's not like the bulletin board down the street where everybody just made the same string, so somebody stored it as a keystroke macro, okay? If you make somebody go through some unique, unambiguous character string that when you put it into the English language says, sure, I read it. That's the only way I could have typed this in to go on. Okay, you're making a little bit of advantage for yourself. As I said, most people haven't followed this that I've recommended this to for a very important reason. There's always a tension in doing contract type of junk with a consumer, especially with consumer-oriented services, of scaring people away. And some people don't really come to this until it comes time to look at what they've created, look at what they've wrought. And they say, nobody's going to want to come to my service. Or they say, hey, I'm not getting all the sign-ups I thought I would get by now. And they start looking over everything. And they're saying, huh, maybe all that contract stuff scaring them away a little bit. So that's a very active tension. I work with that tension in my practice as a lawyer, with people in the online business, with software people, just kind of the more traditional software business. It comes up all over the place when you're in business. You know, you don't want to scare people away. That's a marketing issue, really. And there's always a marketing versus protecting yourself tension that you kind of have to work. You can't avoid the issue if you're concerned about protecting yourself or if you're concerned about marketing. You know, you just can't avoid it. And you have to kind of just keep track of that. Very quickly, I want to mention a couple of other things. As Ken said, there's a variety of things. And that's also, as I said, why I think contracts are important. You kind of handle the whole variety. I also think systems are ugly with a lot of notices all over the place. And I would disagree with anybody who thinks that's really nice to look at. I mean, they can go find systems like that. I don't like to walk into a store and have a bunch of signs on my face telling me what I can and can't do. And that's kind of what it is when you put a bunch of notices up. So I recommend to people to try to find some discreet way to do it. And that's a marketing thing. I'm a lawyer, but I'm try to help out on that side. Now, there are things that people say, like, police are not allowed. Well, forget that. You know, they'll come in. You know, I mean, can you imagine a drug dealer, policemen not welcome. You know, I don't think that's going to stop anything. It just doesn't work that way, okay? So I don't even want to talk about it beyond that. I also want to mention that disclaimers, you buy a curling iron, you buy a ladder, you buy a hammer, you buy baby clothes, all kinds of stuff. There's always disclaimers on these products. You know, limited warranty, no warranty, limited liability. You know, right up front, you know, pretty much in your face when you buy this stuff. There's a long commercial tradition with fairly successful results that, you know, because there's a commercial norm here, which manufacturers have to be able to sell products with a certain degree of protection. Now, we know there are these big product liability suits, okay, so it's not, you know, far from perfect, but there is some level of protection in disclaimers that comes from a separate tradition than other aspects of the contract of what a user can do on the system. Okay, so one thing that I tend to recommend to people, okay, and it's not legal advice, whatever, okay, is that sometimes you can separate the disclaimers from the rest of it and put them more up front. And there's a big marketing concern again. Okay, if you start disclaiming stuff as people go in, they might feel they're walking into a booby trap of some kind. So it takes a lot of careful consideration. This is not something like, oh yeah, that's the answer, that's how I'll do it. And it has a lot to do with how you want to run your system.
And I'm surprised you stopped short of testing the user on having read the rules.
That's a good idea.
I do think that click wrap is stronger than shrink wrap. But I'm glad you mentioned the other cases, because one of them in the Third Circuit, which did not enforce the terms of a shrink wrap license, had a set of facts that might be instructive here. That was one in which there was a telephone conversation pursuant to which the software, which typical box software, was sold in a conversation, and then the box was sold out with the shrink wrap on it. And what the court held was that the written text of that agreement was really an offer to modify an agreement that had previously been reached on the telephone, and therefore, not having been accepted, was not binding on the party. So in those situations where you have a conversation or a telephone inquiry by users first, you are running a special risk that whatever you put on the screen will not then be viewed as effective.
Any other comments right now?
One other comment I want to say, that there is a collection on FidoNet on a couple of the boards that provide support for BBS law of sample screens, of sample questionnaires, of sample user contracts that you might want to get and look at for an example.
Okay, I appreciate you. Please do, but please also, I would like to emphasize, don't take the ready-made solution and just say, slap it on.
Yeah.
It does require thinking about it. You know, I don't know if you have to think about it like a lawyer or not, but this is one of the areas where if you are concerned about protecting yourself from liability, I believe you have to invest a little bit of your thought process in how it's going to work here. Next.
I think you guys answered about 98% of my question about online contracts and their legitimacy. One thing I did kind of want to ask as a point of clarification, if I do have an online contract and they need to say yes I agree or something at the bottom that seems to be reasonably agreed upon that's binding to some degree, I guess there's not any real test cases on that. If I need to modify that in some way, what do I have to go through to tell my users that I am modifying that and that the conditions are somehow changed?
Well, let me ask you this, are you running it as a separate program, like a sub program?
No.
Once they're in and they never have to go back to that?
They call the number. They get a welcome screen. Hello, welcome to Buying BBS.
Uh-huh.
Do you want to join? Yes. Here's the contract. Do you agree?
Yes.
It's like three it's the first thing you get to, essentially.
Well, I have to say that the only, you know, to the extent that the original contract is binding, you're going to have to go through the same process for the modifications.
So you have to get them to agree again for the second
There are other ways to get them to agree, but, you know, I mean, you could have, for example, one-to-one correspondence with every one of your users and get them to agree that way. I don't think it's going to be the you can't modify it by taking sort of the disclaimer approach, which we've already criticized, by just posting notice. The contract has hereby been changed. If you don't like it, get out of here. Right. You know, you can't do that. So you're going to have a further, you're going to have to negotiate, and or at least you're going to have that further interaction to get some kind of agreement about the changes in the terms.
Can you put something in the original contract saying that the SysOp reserves rights to change?
Well, I think I would argue that it's a permissible contract to enter into with somebody that says we're agreeing on these terms, but there are certain areas that will be subject to change, but with two caveats on that. One, there's got to be effective notice. I'm not sure you have to go all the way to negotiation, but if you don't go to negotiation, then I think the other essential element is to give anybody the right to quit anytime if they don't like the change, because then
I seem to remember seeing the contract, the sample contract in the SysLaw book, and it said, I'm just kind of pulling this off of memory, I believe it said someplace in that you do have to kind of give some sort of reasonable notice that the contract is going to be changed, and provided that is given, your
and when you just one word on that, when you one of the most effective things you can do to protect yourself against complaints is to make clear that somebody has a right to quit any time, make sure that they get a refund for whatever they might have paid that wasn't used up, because that tends to diffuse complaints. I mean, it doesn't solve all the problems, but they're going to quit if they don't want the system anyway, so you might as well make clear that you're the customer's right.
Yep. It also tends to look good to a judge if, God forbid, something like that ever went to a courtroom. You say to the judge, he didn't like the change, I gave him his money back, the judge will tend to look at the other guy and say, why are we here? I mean, that's one of the sequences that you see. I'll also point out that the types of things that Dave was talking about are, from what I've seen, and I was kind of a big company lawyer before I became a little company lawyer in the past, is the norm in online service situations where large companies have a lot of money at stake. They will not anybody predicating a large part of the business on having some kind of deal with an online service to get something will always require in their contract some kind of notice, some kind of and on the other hand, the one providing will always require the ability to make changes, because they're going to be upgrading their equipment. They're going to have policy changes from the boss, and who knows how to deal with that except to change the rest of the company, whatever. And they reserve the right to make changes. So one guy always reserves the right to make changes. The other guy usually always makes sure to protect their rights. Large company situations, sometimes it's like, sure, you can make a change, and I can get out of it, and I can force you to keep me on a year the old way while I'm figuring out what to do. That happens in large company context. Obviously, you don't want to necessarily extend that to users. But there's a whole tradition, a whole way that the business in the larger sense is already operating that you can work within. It's it will be accepted because that's the custom of the business as a whole.
I'm with a group in Taos, New Mexico, and we're trying to set up a telecommunity group there that's basically a free net type of organization. But one of the ways that we are thinking about supporting that organization is by some commercial ventures on this network that we're going to be setting up. And is there any problem with using commercial services to help support a nonprofit foundation?
Okay, you're talking, when you say problem, you mean a tax problem?
Yeah, I suppose so. In terms of your nonprofit status, I mean, using commercial ventures to support a nonprofit organization, is there a problem with, somehow imperiling your organization?
Hang on a second. Wait a second. Have you received any advice in general on it? Are you asking, does a bulletin board mean something different? I mean, I can say something about it generally, or I'm asking, are you saying there's something special about bulletin boards that you should know about?
Well, I'm saying, what I'm asking is that, if you have a foundation, a nonprofit foundation, and you want to support that foundation, which, I mean, part of the process here is to have a bulletin board system. And in that bulletin board system, we're going to have commercial ventures, which people will pay for in order to support the free part of this whole system, which is under the umbrella of this
Sounds like you're asking a general question. I mean, it's really kind of irrelevant For the analysis, whether it's on about a bulletin board or any other commercial venture.
Right.
Okay. I'm not going to get into all the different kinds of nonprofit organizations there are, and I'm not going to ask you what kind you have either. I'll just mention that in a very general way, nonprofit, when you have a preferred tax status if you're a nonprofit type operation, it does require that you're not engaging in commercial businesses. The theory behind that is, why is the government granting you an exemption from taxes if you're just going to use it to compete unfairly with companies that do pay taxes? It's a level playing field type of concern. You should be staying within the nonprofit area, not unfairly making profits just like profit-making companies, but not paying taxes on them. You can make what might count as profits as long as it's not considered commercial. And there's generally activities within the purpose of the nonprofit corporation, nonprofit organization, are okay if they're going to be used to raise money to further. You know, if you're doing an educational kind of thing, if you put out a lot of pamphlets, in pursuit of that educational objective, and you happen to sell them and make a little money off it, that's fine. That's not going to do anything.
The bake sale is okay.
The bake sale is okay. The bake sale is okay. Right. Fairly traditional type things. A bulletin board. If your objective is to educate people, and you set up a bulletin board, that's educating people, and you charge a price of admission, and that money is going back into the operation to run the thing. That's not going to be a problem either. Now, if you start renting it out to commercial operations to do something, or if you kind of move outside of your purpose as told to the IRS to get the exemption in the first place, okay, you can start getting into commercial ventures too, up to a point. And we're not going to get into exactly where that point is. But as long as it's only a marginal amount, as long as it's only a certain amount, you're not going to affect your not-for-profit status, okay? I'm not going to tell you how much that amount is. You can do a certain amount. But the extent to which you do the commercial activity will be taxable. If 15% of your activity as a whole is commercial, okay, in the sense of not being part of your purpose, but is considered like a profit-making, a profit activity, that 15% will be taxed. You have to pay income tax to the IRS or whatever. The rest won't be. And as long as you keep it below a certain amount and don't even use 15% as an indicator, your overall nonprofit status will not be affected. And you have to see a lawyer about that. I'm just giving you very general outlines of how it works.
One other unrelated question. It seems to me like, the kind of information that you find on bulletin board systems is much the same in many cases that you'd find in the newspaper or newsletters and other kinds of print media or even broadcast media. And those media are covered by a lot of laws which seem to protect them in a reasonable fashion. Now, why wouldn't those, or do those same laws, or would they protect, the operators of BBSs, which provide much the same sort of information? Because you're talking about all these other problems and, that all this electronic stuff has to have a new set of guidelines, but in fact, there's already, it seems like, a very good set of guidelines in place for the print media.
I think it's the case that if you're a SysOp, you're at least as protected as a newspaper publisher. But the problem is this. Normally, BBS operators don't pre-screen the comments that are posted by users. That's unlike the way a newspaper or magazine publishes. If a newspaper or magazine posts something defamatory or otherwise legally problematic, it's well established that we can hold the publisher and the editors, as well as the originator, liable for defamation, for example, partly because part of the justification of this is that there's a process under which the original material has been approved and been adopted, as it were, by the operator of the news magazine, of the newspaper or the magazine. But I'll give you a scenario. If you're a bulletin board operator and every day you get up in the morning and between 6 and 8 every morning you read every posting on your bulletin board system and you delete all the stuff that seems like it's bad or could be create legal problems, what about, and you do that over every 24-hour period, what happens then when you go into work and then somebody at 8:10 posts something defamatory and is up on your system for 20 hours? There are real issues about whether the SysOp ought to be held liable in that context the dynamic of a bulletin board system is such that the posters typically have access to the rest of the public without being mediated by the SysOp or by any editorial process. One model that's been advanced to address this particular issue is the secondary publisher model, which, by the way, Ed Cavazos talks about in his law review article, and which also is raised in a case called Cubby versus CompuServe. There are other possible solutions, but there are serious issues about whether you, as a SysOp, want to be held accountable for every single thing that a poster says, unless you're online 24 hours a day and are pre-screening everything. Newspapers are a different animal. It ought to be the case that you have at least the protection that a newspaper editor has, but because there is no editorial process, you may need a different structure for a different structure of First Amendment protection. And this is a hot issue. There's immense debate on this issue. And so that's the extent to which this medium requires maybe something a little bit different. And we can argue about that.
Well, I agree that there are lots of models. The problem really is that there are too many models. And the question is whether what you have is a bar or a library or a bookstore or a newspaper and all those things are what the battleground is when you go into a case about what your duty was and what someone's rights were and so forth. Over the long term, the history, I think, tells us that new media tend finally to be understood in their own terms, and that should really be a goal here. I think there's a possibility that if the courts are not quick enough to apply the right to really understand the media and apply a model that takes into account the limitations on what kind of screening can be done in this environment and so forth, that in fact there may be a case for a legislative enactment that addresses the particular kinds of systems that are not quite common carriers, and you certainly don't want to be common carriers, and that are not quite publishing because you're not the source of all the material, and that are somewhere in between. I think the outlines of the right solution are well agreed upon generally, which is that if you're not adopting a message as your own, if you're not systematically screening things with regard to their individual content, but really just creating an area where a certain kind of message can be posted, if you're not otherwise taking steps to prevent the identification of a wrongdoer if the wrong is done, then there is a good case that, and if you respond reasonably in response to notice that there has been some wrong, then there's a good case that you ought not yourselves be liable for some wrong done through your system. But that is not a combination of factors that is clearly embodied in some easy-to-invoke model. So it'll either grow as applied in particular cases applicable to this industry, or it may be that there will be a faster and better way to get there through a statute regime.
Okay, Mike, one thing. This will be the last comment. The session is ending after Mike's comment.
One thing, what David has done, although he didn't tell you that, he's outlined a proposed bit of legislation called the Electronic Communications Forwarding Act. It already is being talked about setting up a different kind of legal regime that would protect people who are not adopting messages that are posted or passed through their system.
Okay, thank you, Michael, and thank all of you for coming.